Before we get to the thrilling conclusion of the String Trilogy, a word from our friends at Signature Books. When Joseph Smith founded the Church of Christ in 1830, he declared it to be God's restoration of true Christianity, the kingdom of God on earth. Although he foresaw opposition to such bold claims, he could not fathom that time and unforeseen circumstances would help to spawn hundreds of offshoots and competing denominations, all claiming their origins in a movement born and sustained originally by Smith and Sidney Rigdon. Many of these groups have endured and boast multiple congregations of believers in many countries. Others came and went quickly and have long since been forgotten. Some have survived, but have only appealed to a handful of believers. Steve Shields has for decades chronicled the various origins and paths of all known restoration movements. This fifth edition of his encyclopedic study includes recent groups born as internet communities. That so many groups and individuals have been unsatisfied with the more mainstream Mormon churches, yet cling to tenets of the Smith-Rigdon movement, speaks to the strengths of the restoration concept and the naive view that one denomination can successfully meet all the needs of believers. Divergent Paths of the Restoration, an Encyclopedia of the Smith-Rigdon Movement by Stephen Shields, new from Signature Books. Get it from Benchmark Books or wherever you buy your Mormon books.
Why should I be standing in line, just waiting for bread?
Hi, this is Lindsay Hanson Park.
And this is Brian Buchanan.
Bringing you the story of Mormonism from the shadow of the everlasting hills, straight out of Zion. This isn't your grandpa's Mormon history.
Well, I have sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I have sinned so gravely, Brother Young.
This is the tale of Mormon saints and sinners from our roots until present day. Saddle up.
Gird your loins, lock your hearts, and pay your tithing, because we're bringing you the story of Mormonism in all its paradisiacal glory.
It's the Sunstone History Podcast.
Well, I've sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I've sinned so gravely, Brother Young. That only you can save me, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. But only you can save me, Brother Young.
Welcome back for the third and final installment of String Wars. Da-da-da-da. While we can't offer you any Ewoks, what if we told you that as late as 1850s began, String was involved with several concubines on Beaver Island? How does that compare to Ewoks? I'm curious.
Hopefully less furry.
You never know.
You never know.
Poor Rockwell's wives were a little rough. Just kidding. They were not. He was rough. Concubines. I love that word, concubines.
It just sounds weird.
I feel like, you know, depending on the Mormon personality, depends on what they call plural marriage. You know, you've got some spiritual wifery. You've got some polygamy. You've got some celestial marriage. The higher law. What are the other names?
Bonded marriage comes into this. I mean, you have all... we're even starting to use polyamory like the rest of the world, so.
Well, here we're using the word concubines, and this term, obviously hearkening back all the way to the Hebrew Bible, has always been a little bit of, I don't know, a puzzle for Christians. Harem, that's another one.
Harem.
That's another one. Generally speaking, it usually refers to a woman in a plural relationship that was of a lower social standing, and we called it celestial marriage. This was sort of the case here. These women were having children with String, but apparently not publicly recognized as wives. He did the concubine thing, huh?
And Helen Mar was like, yeah, I know what that's like. Not the children part yet, but not being publicly recognized. So we did that in Nauvoo also. And just as a teaser for later, George Q. Cannon was particularly interested in the idea of concubines and brought it up multiple times. And you'll understand why later. Hopefully, that beginning will tip you off to the fact that the last period of String's life was going to be hopping. In July 1850, the faithful were invited to a major conference. They had some, let's say, unusual preparations for the conference. Everyone had to take the oath of the Illuminati. We mentioned this in our interview with Dr. Rossetti last time. They put their hand on a Bible and swore allegiance to Mr. James Strang, quote, the imperial primate and actual sovereign lord and king on earth, the true and lawful sovereign, whensoever and in whatsoever kingdom, state, or domain. Finally, just in case folks weren't totally clear on what the score was, they promised to, quote, yield obedience to the revelations he shall give and the decrees he shall make as the supreme law, above and superseding all laws, obligations, and mandates of any other person, authority, or power whatsoever. And remind me again why outsiders are always so suspicious of Mormons?
Rumors of this oath got out, and hold your gasps for just a minute. Folks were concerned. The response was actually pretty wild. A plan quickly developed to celebrate the 4th of July by kicking out these anti-American Mormon weirdos. Jeez, I wonder why. So they were going to come in the dark of night with guns and get ready to break up the Strangite conference the next morning. And before you start thinking this was some great, noble demonstration of principle, they apparently planned to kill all the leaders and then assault all the women and torch the place. That's not great. And in this case, the Gentiles apparently really sucked at keeping secrets, thank goodness, just as much as the Mormons. So Strang and company heard all about the coming mob and planned their counterattack. They got a hold of a cannon, their own arsenal, and even a ship full of armed dudes anchored just offshore. Now he's pirate of Beaver Island.
Yar, I be James Strang. I really, like, I'd love to see him with, like, a handlebar mustache and a nice sword. I think he would have done well at that.
But he's wearing a raccoon skin cap.
Yeah, he's got his checkerboard pants and his tricolor tri-corner hat on. It would have been a good sight. And as the rhetoric tends to do in these kinds of situations, it got super militant very quickly. The dudes gathered to hear a win one for the Gipper speech from Strang. He told them, quote, I will execute with my own hands the sentence of death against the enemies relative to putting up a mob. Give me four men who don't falter where I lead, and I will make a full end of all our enemies. Nothing ominous about that one. The apocalyptic stew was definitely simmering by this point. The women and children were sheltered in the tabernacle. On the morning of July 4th, they started firing the cannon as a patriotic signal, but it also worked really well to demonstrate to the would-be attackers that the Mormons were packing. Amazingly, given everything we just said, it all just kind of fizzled out. Reinforcements for the non-Mormons didn't arrive as planned, and the minor detail of that unexpected cannon made them think twice.
But the threat of invasion definitely did not deter Strang from a good time. Oh no, a few days later, it was time for a truly wild event. Elvira Field, no longer walking around as Charlie Douglas, got to help Strang with a project that seems more like a crappy third grade class project, to be honest. They made a crown out of paper, and then they covered it with gold tinsel. Very regal. I'm not even joking. It was time for Strang to be crowned the king. Oh, and also Imperial Primate of Beaver Island, but king with his tinsel crown and all. Just
so fancy.
Just
such
like
a
third
fancy
grade
man.
Christmas. I can literally hear you thinking, wait, where's John C. Bennett? This is 100% his kind of shenanigans. Amazingly, he wasn't there for it. He was probably sewing on homemade tinsel stars all over his homemade military jacket back at home. Don't fret, though. He did send advice and instructions by letter because, you see, he was now a big-time chicken guy living in Massachusetts and making all those chickens, inventing all those breeds.
Chickens. I guarantee you the different groups of chickens had wildly exotic names. The Exalted Order of the Princely Star Chickens or something.
Did he make them wear gold epaulettes? That's what I want to know.
Undoubtedly. Made out of gold tinsel.
But he even did send fancy... Did he really? Did he really send specially breaded chickens to Beaver Island?
Oh, yes. It was like a coronation present.
No way.
John C. Bennett was tomatoes, sending spiritual wifery, and chickens. That was his resume.
You know you made it when a chicken gets delivered to you on Beaver Island for your coronation.
With a fancy name.
Man, why did my people follow Brigham? Wrong choice.
I want the chicken guy. So when the faithful filed into this meeting, they sat down only to see a big curtain drawn across the stand. At the right moment, about high noon, guys behind go pulla on the cords and revealed Strang sitting on his throne with a crown and a scepter. Strang was in a red robe, so that means he can never be friends with Uncle Warren, obviously. And this event absolutely makes the list of things that you need to hit when you get your time machine working. For many years, everyone argued that this was basically just Strang doing what Joseph Smith did in the Council of 50, having himself crowned king. But honestly, that is not giving the Imperial Primate his well-deserved kudos because, of course, he pulled out all the stops labeled drama and spectacle on his organ. Council of 50 thing was positively boring next to his coronation.
Speak's summary of this crucial period is very helpful. Quote, Strang may have been able to dazzle the young and impressionable members of the congregation with the drama of his coronation. I mean, they had chickens from John C. Bennett.
We've got chickens!
And he may have convinced Elvira Field and other women when he boldly proclaimed himself to the above law, but a growing number of church members were not buying Strang's presumption of royal privilege, and the indignation among the Gentiles was growing ever greater. End quote.
Things were coming apart, and once again, the call was coming from inside the house. Remember earlier when we talked about how the community used the term pseudo for people that grew disaffected? Well, at this point, Strang gets a letter informing him that George Adams has pseudoed. Adams, remember, had earlier been one of the Slime Brothers in Boston, and he was basically Strang's number two at this point. When he first showed up on the island, Adams told everyone that the woman at his side, Louisa Cogswell, was his new wife, his first wife having recently died. Nice try, buddy. His first wife, Caroline, was actually still alive, and it gets much worse. She was dying, and Adams had just dumped her with some people in New Jersey and took off for Beaver Island. And this whole story is just complete plagiarism. You might remember that his partner in Slime, the OG Babes in Toyland villain, John C. Bennett, had showed up in Nauvoo, without mentioning that he had also left his first wife high and dry back at home.
Strang learns what's up. Oh, and P.S. Apparently Adams's wife, Louisa, was a sex worker he met during the Boston days. No shame on that. Sex work is work. And gets in some sort of fight with Louisa. She's not about to let him take the moral high ground and threatened to stab him with a Bowie knife, which is very on brand for the Boston crew. They were a wild bunch.
Beantown and Bowie knives.
Pretty soon, she would have to take a number for that experience, however, because George Adams had been out of town during Stabgate and wasn't super happy with things when he got back. After Louisa was excommunicated, they leave the island and start sharpening their knives. Just, you know, the metaphorical kind this time. Maybe the whistling kind. They go the lawsuit route, accusing Strang of threatening them. The best lawsuit, however, argued that Strang had stolen the props used during the coronation. What props? I mean, like, what props are we talking about?
The tinsel crown, the scepter.
They are very intimidating.
His valuable props.
George Adams, you see, thought he was a big-time actor, and how dare some lowly imperial primate take his fancy Broadway set decorations away?
There are so many just fascinatingly fun elements of the Strang story. That's one of them. And a very interesting question during all this bubbling chaos. Is there something about Mary? Remember, his first wife is kind of fading into the background at this point. Sadly, because we don't have any Strangite Linda Newells and Val Averys, we don't have anyone who's written a killer biography about Mary. We do get one very vintage story about her, however. Mary liked the theater and was part of a dramatic group on the island. During a performance of Pizarro one night, she gets super sick. And no, smart guy, it's not poisoning, just some 19th century ailment. The consumption, the cholera. You can make the list. She's on the verge of death after it, but pulls out of it. However, after that, she does start writing to her relatives for help to get off the island. It's because, sadly, there were more somethings about Mary. Elvira was now several months pregnant. Did Mary know about it? We don't have any direct proof, but it seems likely that Mary was quickly learning that becoming a perfect Sarah in the polygamy system was much more difficult than it sounded.
I gotta say, this whole Strang thing is so bananas. There's, at every turn, there's something. It would make a brilliant reality TV show today. They wouldn't have to recreate anything.
No, don't change a thing.
Just get a camera there. So after another former member complained to the governor, the heat got turned up another notch. And so to combat the dude's allegations, Strang started complaining that the non-Mormon traders in the area had been cutting the whiskey they were selling to the native people who lived throughout the islands. Strang and some of his guys are drafted into a posse to go after the whiskey cutters, but the dude, the former Strangite, escapes them. Now we've got whiskey cutting in here.
Oh, and boat chases. It's nuts.
Boat chases on Beaver Island. That's my Nancy Drew novel. Okay. No, that's.
And the Hardy Boys will do the pirates.
There we go. You can't pair any woman with the name Beaver Island these days.
Not recommended. Just
the Hardy Boys. It's a Beaver Island saga. Still no. Still doesn't work. Okay. So this guy that's being chased turns around and gets warrants for Strang and several dozen of his followers. This crazy boat chase ensues where Strang and company have to hide out in an abandoned shack for a while and survive on whatever stuff they can find. And if you think that kind of adventure sounds fun, just a boot nice. To the Canadian border in the middle of winter, then I don't know what to tell you. Couldn't they get some maple from their trees or something?
One would hope so. By this point, Strang now has a price on his head, and he takes one more page out of the Joseph Smith playbook, go into hiding. More threads of his life start unraveling. He kicks his first wife, Mary, off the island. Elvira had just given birth. It was on April 6th, obviously. This is Strang we're talking about. And they named the little guy Charles. But wait, when Elvira was going incognito, wasn't that her fake name? Yeah, that totally was her name. Oh, and as an adult, Charles would claim that Mary actually tried to kill him when he was a babe. The scriptwriters for the Strang movie have the easiest job in history. They barely deserve any pay for it. It just didn't write itself.
The shiz that was hitting the fan now turned into a federal shiz. Remember the whiskey cutter that narrowly escaped? He, along with the slimy George Adams and other dudes, decide to complain to, wait for it, the president, Millard Fillmore, which our proud sister city of Beaver, Utah, is also named after. Millard Fillmore gets a juicy letter full of all these wild allegations, and he takes them seriously. Good move, Millie old boy. Out in Utah, Brigham Young is just laughing. Bro, just name a county in the middle of nowhere and territorial capital after him. It's not brain surgery. Yeah, pipe down, Brigham. You'll get yours soon.
Mr. President sends a whole warship to Beaver Island to try and nab Strang. One guy on the island offers to play Thomas Kane. He talks Strang out of hiding, and he comes aboard the ship to talk to the district attorney. Strang works his magic, and within 2 hours, every single dude on the island at that point shows up to face the music. They are charged with all sorts of things, including, naturally, counterfeiting. Yeah, that's right, you heard that, Marianne. Strang and a few others are taken to Detroit, and things get a little hairy on the island. When the Imperial Primate is away, the Illuminati will pay. Is that how the saying goes? I forget.
You know, just as long as you have your paper swords to protect you.
Covered with gold tinsel.
Your little cannonballs made of spit wads. What are they doing over there? Dennis the Menace Island. All sorts of vintage fiascos happened. The government seizes a bunch of lumber that the Strangites had cut. One guy gets his head knocked in with a cane, that kind of thing. Paul Bunyan shows up and lectures everybody on their bad behavior. Turned out more serious when a non-Mormon dude is killed during a posse raid. This, not surprisingly, really stirs the pot in the region, and it results in another 20 Strangites being arrested. While they are in jail, they are actually asked to serve as a posse by the sheriff. That's really great. What a twist of events. I mean, at this point, if you're not in a posse or about to be a posse or at least running for a posse, can you even call that living?
It is amazing how many posses are in this story. More so than in Utah, I feel like. It was very surprising. And you could probably write
this. But these posses have tinsel crowns.
Oh, these are tinsel-covered posses. That's the best kind. And I'm guessing you all can write the Strangite response to all this yourself. It's all fake news. It's religious persecution. Copy and paste. And my TLDR on it? Yeah, it's likely that the non-Mormons in the area were probably prone to not liking them. But polygamy, voting in bloc, iffy business dealings, claiming you own everything, and thinking that Strang's word is the law? My dudes in the Restoration, this will never end well. Worlds without end. Your neighbors will not like you. From his jail cell in Detroit, and no word on whether this can accurately be termed the original Malice in the Palace, Strang writes the governor. Now, this is quite the coincidence. The governor writes back and says, "Strangites, your cause is just, but I can do nothing for you." All right, fine. He didn't. We honestly don't even know if he responded at all, which is boring.
When they finally come to trial, they are all found not guilty. All charges are dropped, and that's that. Strang, Mr. Gas is always good on the fire, decides to not just shut up and go back to the island. That would have been a wise choice. He says the trial was stupid in the first place and says, basically, I'm amazed we all got off because the public doesn't like us. Wah, wah, wah. James. Jimmy. Jimbo. You're free, buddy. Go home. Stop poking the bear. When he does finally go back to the island, he immediately fires at the printing press and writes an editorial boasting that, contrary to what everyone thought, the Lord's dudes were freed and, hey, String doesn't even need a bodyguard anymore. That's an interesting flex. Fine, James, do what you want. It is the policy of this podcast not to say I told you so, but, buddy, we told you so.
The locals saw how much fun this lawsuit game was and started filing a million complaints. One guy, named Hezekiah, which is a nice touch, was arrested 20 times and went to jail 5 of those times. And the pseudo count starts rising as a result of all this. Guess what was a major source of disaffection? Yep, it was the pea. Just as in Joseph Smith's Nauvoo, polygamy was a real sifter of the wheat and tares. The relationships with these non-Mormon neighbors were starting to take on a real Missouri vibe. The Mormons took over some houses, or occasionally burned them down, so the people would have no reason to ever come back. String got a letter from a guy, and you tell me it doesn't have some real Danite twang to it. Quote, Brother String, let's give the pseudos and Gentiles their desserts this winter. We can do it if you will be here with us. I do believe there can be 25 boys that will obey your counsel, that can be organized and properly disciplined by that time, which will do executions.
Well, all that whistling and caning had the desired effect, as it does. By spring 1852, the island was almost entirely Mormons. They created a town with String as supervisor and his guys in all the positions. Where have we seen this before?
Doesn't sound familiar.
The structure of the town took an odd blend of Mormon and island life qualities. On the one hand, you were required to clean your fish by the shore. Not inland, like a weirdo. Also, tithing was required and was used for infrastructure and taxes. And in polygamy news, in case you thought we forgot about that, the Wisconsin Mormons were starting to hear about the official announcement of the pea out there in Utah. This is 1852 now. In another example in a long history of Mormons not reading the room well, String picked up his editorial pen from the Northern Islander and reminded people, hey, polygamy isn't forbidden by common law. Reading it, you almost think one of the Brighamites had written it. String says, listen, if they had opened 40 brothels in Utah, no one would have blinked an eye. Oh, and you might have guessed it already. String had the topic on his mind because, behind the scenes, he had just married another plural wife, Betsy McNutt of Beaver Island.
They had good names. You have an Elvira, Betsy McNutt.
Betsy McNutt she runs the apple chutney stand on Beaver Island. Wait, what do they grow on Beaver Island?
They most lumber. It was lumber and fish, mostly. Fish chutney? Gross.
McNutt fish chutney. Get it while it's cold.
That's what the kids got on Halloween at their house. That's disgusting. One of the many great features of Vicky Speak's history of String and the movement is that she pays attention to things that dudes might not. For example, you get a really interesting extended discussion of how women on the island wore bloomers rather than dresses. The older women really didn't love it, and visitors got riled up that the women were not wearing pants. Seriously. One guy said he did not care how many women were married to one man, quote, but the trousers I do not like.
That sounds so familiar to me again.
I can't imagine where our modern hyperfixation on what women wear comes from. This must be a new thing.
Wear pants to church day. There, I guarantee some of the guys hating on us online were men that didn't mind the polygamy, actually.
No, but the trousers. I do not like. That actually would have been a really fun shirt to have had, the trousers I do not like.
I know. It's because pants is a naughty word in the UK, so.
This is true, yes.
Which I didn't learn until wear pants to church day. Wear trousers to church.
It's. Vicky points out that though it seemed fairly quiet at this point, accusations were definitely on the rise. Claims of piracy by desperados on the island were everywhere. Well, when the going gets tough, then run for office?
Are you still drinking root beer out there? Because, gee, I wonder where String got that idea. Somebody's on episode 3 of String totally sugar sick from all that root beer. We're sorry. Unlike his predecessor, a combination of redistricting and a unanimous vote for String on the island meant that he was overwhelmingly elected as a state representative. He actually did it. He ran for office and won. The other candidates had no idea he was even running before Election Day, and it was really Joseph Smith 2.0. He told people, listen, I don't really want to be a politician, but we can't just get the respect we want any other way, so I guess I'll just have to be in charge. When he arrives in the Capitol, surprise, surprise, a big stink is made and he has to defend himself. After the James Strang hearings, he is allowed to take his seat. B.H. Roberts could have taken some lessons from him because Strang actually had some good press as a legislator. It was probably his crown he wore around everywhere. They're like, that guy's regal.
Who's that 5 foot tall guy in the crown?
He's in charge.
He's a go-getter.
No, newspapers said he was always well-prepared and a good speaker for his causes. That's very head-patty, but you know, if I saw a little man in a crown, I'd be like, you go, girl.
You're doing a good job there, buddy. But you know who really didn't appreciate Representative Strang? His constituents. The non-Mormon ones, obviously. The other islands were not a fan of the growing Mormon influence. They held a meeting where, we assume, Helen Lovejoy screeched from the back, "Won't somebody please think of the non-Mormons?" And where have we heard this story before? Strang kept writing editorials in the Northern Islander, trying to explain away all these accusations. Further little dust-ups made it clear there was a divide in the region and it was not going to be healed. Nearby Mackinac Island had long been the economic center of the region, but the Mormons had decisively swung the momentum their way. It didn't help. The newspapers loved to print any story where Mormons were the bad guys. Robbing people, stealing horses, intimidating juries. Back to Nauvoo, just how guilty were the Mormons on the island?
Turns out that a lot of the piracy allegations were due to, wait for it, actual pirates? In one case, it was a bunch of dudes sailing on the Mary Clark. Guys, come on, you have to pick a more metal name for your boat if you're going to be pirates. Mary Clark? Really?
Oh no, here comes the Mary Clark. We better scatter.
Quick, get your paper swords! Despite the real pirates, things were going downhill. Strang was picking up steam. Think of it as his Joseph Smith, I don't know, 1843 period. He married two women, boom, boom, who were cousins. And Vicky Speak makes an interesting and important point about these women. They were all very intelligent and active in civic matters. Just dumb for marrying... Well, are you dumb when you marry King of Beaver Island?
I mean, you're going to get more fish than anyone else, so...
You know, he's now a politician. He's a leader. He's imperial primate.
I mean...
he's the one mighty and strong. What more
Mom,
could you want in a guy?
He's an imperial primate.
A fascinating element of their lives involved the division of labor. Elvira continued to be his secretary, while Sarah, one of the new wives, was a teacher. What's really fun is if you... meet plural families now. Sometimes if the guy runs his own business, one of his wives is often the secretary, and that's kind of her time.
Yes. And that usually doesn't go well. The other wives always hate it.
I know, because she's with him all the time.
Wife at home doing laundry. Nuts. No, she wasn't some boring English teacher. She was a priesthood teacher. Yeah, you heard us. Within the Strang Church, as Vicky points out, quote, a teacher must be educated in letters and science. Which, of course, oddly enough, are the exact same qualifications for the snot-nosed 14-year-olds out in the Utah church. She was a priesthood teacher. I thought that was kind of cool. And she wasn't the only one, apparently. For the record, all these polygamous marriages that were going on were equally as illegal as they had been, and would be, in basically every place the Mormons ever set foot. And the island Mormons were maybe even more loose-lipped about it than the Nauvoo guys had been. And you had predictable clickbait things like an article, how some girls died by suicide rather than be a plural wife. Sounds like England later on. Then you also had Strang writing yet more editorials about the awesomeness of polygamy. And a kind of weird turn of events, they would reprint similar articles from their cousins out in Utah. And so the principle was just gradually multiplying. I'm a rattlesnake daddy.
Hold on. old calendar 1856. I know that maybe doesn't register much with you, but pretend like I just said June 1844. There, did that do something for you? They were partying on the island like it was 1899. However, King Strang was off at the state capital representing again. He had been re-elected, and now the Gentiles in the region were really getting pissed. They rolled up their vintage sleeves, pulled out their Sharpie brand quills, and tried to redistrict the hell out of those Mormons. Despite the ominous developments in the background, it again seemed like the world was Strang's oyster, and the lumber industry was on a different plane. Terrible. It was truly terrible. They're fired. Some of this lumber was going into the rebooted Tabernacle project, and they were planning for several thousand in the building, giving a sense of how high their hopes were. It was, of course, named St. James Hall. No word on whether the building was also 5 feet tall, though.
That was really mean. I would never say such things about the Imperial Primate. Interestingly, it seems like Strang was moving some strings behind the curtains and exploring escape locations like Texas or Canada. Far away, in the west, Brigham Young was yelling, "No, not Texas. That skin of a fart, Lyman White already did that one." There were ominous, very much shark-like rumors in the air. One attempt at raising a mob failed, quote, "for want of numbers and whiskey." And isn't it always just that way? Numbers and whiskey.
Always.
But remember, friends, Strang is fronting a Joseph Smith tribute band here. It's not the Gentiles we're worried about. You have to look inside the whited sepulcher, or something like that.
The Strangites were getting restless. Wait, what's his cover band called? What do we call it? Imperial Primates, I feel like, does the job. It's kind of punk rock.
Yeah. I introduced my kids to a great late 60s song called Fire.
Mm-hmm.
And I forgot it's the Crazy World of Arthur Brown is the band name.
Okay.
It's fantastic.
That sounds good.
The crazy world of the Imperial.
I just see them with their crowns out on stage, you know, jumping around, Banksy t-shirts of monkeys with crowns on.
And a dude in a monkey suit comes out like partway through and starts playing the bass. A pirate monkey. There you go.
Well, we've thought a lot about this, Brian. So the Strangites were getting restless. Lots of drinking. Okay, sure. Women, though, were not wearing bloomers. I guess these really are the last days. So back to the booths for just a second, though. Strang and loyalists were making increasingly aggressive public denunciations regarding guys they felt were universal deadheads and sponges. Is that really a quote?
Mm-hmm.
Deadheads.
Deadheads.
See? Yeah. We got a thing going. Two guys, including our guy Hezekiah from earlier, start to be the focal point around which a circle of increasingly angry dudes starts to swirl. Strang gets a packet full of dozens of letters written by various people that are dripping with threats. The primate brings it up in a meeting and tells the audience that if it starts to go down, they should fight it out in the end.
And remember earlier when the ship docked at the island and took Strang to Detroit a few years back? Well, the ship came back to the island. This time, instead of a network of Strang loyalists, the ship captain has a bunch of pseudos come aboard and start telling tales. The old threats of robbing and pirates were recycled, as well as what I think the deal breaker was. Strang was trying to implement God's law as the law. And yep, that's Nauvoo playing out all over again. The ship left, but returned just a few days later, which got them confused. This time, Hezekiah gave the captain a list of all the bigwigs on the island. His goal? Nothing less than a, quote, complete overthrow of the kingdom. One man is dispatched from the ship to go round up the Imperial Primate himself.
I read this, by the way, as calm as a summer's mom. And it took me like five.
Stacy's mom?
Wow, we're really going with it. Strang apparently came willingly, as calm as a summer's mom. As calm as a summer's morn, you might say. No word on whether he stopped at every single house on the whole damn island to tell them about the lambs and the slaughters. Group gathers, and just as Strang steps onto the dock, two dudes open fire. Why? Why did they do this? One of them shooting him in the head just behind the ear. Witnesses would later say the man was Willard Richards. It's a solid joke. I know because I've seen all the documents, Brian.
In 4K?
I mean, it's equally backed up by the sources. Another shoots him in the kidney, and one of them pistol whips Strang in the face until his gun breaks. Ouch. Yeah, that's pretty brutal. The dude hops on the ship, pull anchor, and get the hell out of Dodge. They did this in front of people. There were children there.
There's like 40 people there. The dudes get delivered to a very happy sheriff in nearby Mackinac. While they're in jail, the locals bring them all the comforts of 19th century life. Tobacco, pipes, sugared brandy. When the locals told the sheriff if he actually locked them up, they would rip the place apart. So he just takes them back to his house instead. Yeah, the support for this murder was basically the same as it had been in Illinois in 1844. The guys go on trial after a few days and sit down for this one, friends. They were acquitted. I know. I was surprised too. At first, the argument was that the shooting took place on the water, which is definitely not state jurisdiction. But then this legal whiz kid pipes up that no, it was on the dock. And we all know that the dock bone is connected to the land bone. And that is state jurisdiction. And now this is double jeopardy and we better just let them all go. No word on whether the skin fell off their bones in later years and maggots came crawling out of their eye sockets.
I'm going to guess yes, always. Back on the island, things play out about as well as the aftermath of Ford's Theater just a decade later. They get him back to his house where he tells them not to retaliate. Basically, answer them nothing. Brian's ring. Did your phone just ring, Brian?
Apes, wait.
They start to hear news that warrants are out for basically all the dudes on the island, so they pack up the Imperial Primate and board a boat and sail for Wisconsin. The weather was so crazy, it took them 4 days to reach the mainland. Next up is a train trip. By this point, String is probably thinking that hospice care on the island was actually sounding pretty good. They try to get First Wife Mary back to say her goodbyes. String was actually not doing as bad as you might think. The wound in his head was almost healed, but the shot in the back had paralyzed him. String knew the end was near. He told people exactly that, but ironically, given that this is a succession crisis episode, he blows it in the ninth inning. One guy asks him specifically about his successor, and String just cries and says he doesn't want to talk about it. He didn't talk about it and died hours later. Unlike Joseph Smith, no Brigham Young was waiting in the wings, and that was about all she wrote.
While String's version of Mormonism faded, mostly, it still exists, but never anywhere near the levels of the 1840s and 50s. For a time, it was easily the most viable alternative to the Brigham and Heber show out in Utah. In the interim, until young Joseph was finally persuaded to lead the coalescing RLDS movement, James String put on a pretty convincing Joseph Smith cover band concert. I think we can all agree that the Imperial Primate had some game.
I would say that someday seven kids are going to travel in Beaver Island. There they'll find an old boat with the skeleton of James String and his eye patch, find a treasure, and save their home back in Goondocks. Yes?
Absolutely. I'd watch that, wouldn't you?
I would watch that. He would make a good one-eyed Willy.
I think so.
Short and...
Wait, is that him over there? I can't see. He's, there's a couch in
front of him. Yes, look at the crown. The crown is in
the way. Oh, I see the crown. That's him. That's a tinsel crown right there.
Mikey, it's a tinsel crown.
I like you, cause you have such loving ways. Hey, hey, I like you, cause you are so sweet, so neat, so cute, and everything, baby, I like. Start a loving and you'll smile. Start a loving.
Oh, whew, those are big blue eyes.
Hypnotized. Every time I look at you.
With the lights out, it's less dangerous. Here we are now. Entertain us with the Books of Mormons report. Brought to you by Benchmark Books. Let's talk about now the modern state of String studies. 20 years after Roger Van Noort's excellent book on the group, Vicky Speak, a many generations LDS Mormon, came across a road sign. And you, my friends, are all the wiser for it. Her curiosity about Mormon Road and why there were Mormons in Wisconsin led her to write a fantastic history of String and his church. As we have pointed out, her book is particularly valuable for its coverage of String's wives, other women in the movement, and the social nature of the movement. Highly recommended. More recently, Miles Harvey has published King of Confidence, a tale of utopian dreamers, frontier schemers, true believers, false prophets, and the murder of an American monarch. Sadly, I bet your copy isn't inscribed to you as the Imperial Primate of the Illuminati or something. He was very, very cool about doing that when I asked.
You asked him, of course you did.
Absolutely. Also, from a journalism background, mixed with English professor, Harvey looks at String in the national eye. As we talked about, he tends to be more cynical about String's claims. Very well written, and it's a good counterpoint to Vicky Speak's book. As always, you can pick up these books and everything else you need in the Mormon universe from Benchmark Books. Visit Benchmark in Salt Lake City or at benchmarkbooks.com.
Won't you send destroying day nights, Brother Young? Spill my blood upon the earth, oh Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I beg you, spill my blood, oh Brother Young. And let it smoke ascend to heaven, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. And let my breast be cut asunder, Brother Young. As an offering for my sins, a smoking incense, Brother Young, a blood atoning for my sinning, Brother Young. 'Cause I sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I sinned so gravely, Brother Young. Let only you can save me, Brother Brigham, Brother Young.
But only the song you heard today is called Brother Brigham, Brother Young by an artist, Corb Lund. Check out his music at corblund.com and consider giving a donation to sunstone.org to support this podcast.